And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast live from New York City. We're in a little bit of a, you know, off the beaten path change of plans for us. We are joined by, I'm just going to call you a famous person. Famous person, Super Bulls fan, which we will talk about, which is the tenuous reason for me to have you on.
That's the excuse.
And you're a cool guy. Ike Barinholtz, you have a new movie that is out. It's in New York and L.A. soon.
It's in New York, L.A., and D.C. this weekend, and then the following week, the 19th, we're everywhere.
It's called The Oath, and it is – I'll just describe it for people.
Please.
Because you're sick of talking. You're on one of these press junkets.
Oh, my God. Like, I'm not kidding you. I'm loquacious. I love my own voice.
Yes.
And, like, I hate myself. I hate everything about me. But with that said, you make a movie for a year, and you show it to the same, you know, 80 people or so, and – to now go on the road and like talk to people after they've seen it and to like promote it, I swear to you, it's fun.
Has anyone ever written like a profile of you where in the first paragraph they note what you were eating during the profile? That's my favorite celebrity profile. Ike Barinholtz nibbling on a salmon salad.
Ike Barinholtz tucked away in an egg white omelet.
What was it then? What were you eating? You gotta choose carefully. That's, if it's like Ike Barinholtz having beef stroganoff at 11 in the morning.
Ike Barinholtz's knuckles were into a bowl of calamari dip. I never have. My profile is I have never been that in depth. I've always been like fun, but hey, something to shoot for.
Yeah.
Jeez, man. Thanks. You just made me realize I've never been interviewed while eating.
Not properly. It hasn't been proper.
I've been eating. Barinholtz said through mouthfuls of flaming hot Cheetos, what was the question?
So The Oath. The Oath is a movie about how terrible Thanksgiving dinner has been since like 2015, really.
Pretty much.
Since Trump came on the scene. How fragile the politeness of that situation can be since Donald Trump rose.
And our inability to pivot into other stuff.
So it's called The Oath because the premise of the movie is unnamed president. Or he has a name. I can't remember what it is.
Yeah, but it's not Trump.
Unseen president.
Yeah. Unaffiliated.
It could be.
I named him Trump.
Is that in the script?
No. It's like Connor or something.
He's unaffiliated. I don't think they ever say what party he is.
No.
But it's clear what party he is.
I think a little wink.
Has created a voluntary oath in which citizens pledge their loyalty to either him or the nation or both.
Or both.
Your character, who is the patriarch of a family, has is having all the extended family over for Thanksgiving. Has not signed the oath out of like, this is America.
Well, he's a real liberal guy, my guy. He's like a true hardcore liberal who's outraged by what's happened.
Yeah.
And he can't believe it. And this is the end of America. And so he refuses to sign.
And then other visiting family members have a different take on America and loyalty and patriotism, and drama ensues.
Thrilling drama. Action drama.
Well, I want to talk about this because I read and listened to a lot of interviews with you leading up to this, because if I am nothing if not prepared.
You are prepared. Yeah. Everyone says Zach Lowe, podcast is great. He's prepared. The guy, he's on it. And that's why I agreed to do it. And it's not because we're friends with Dave Stassen.
No. So, and you mentioned in some of the interviews that like dystopian films like Children of Men influenced this movie. Children of Men being one of my, it was like one of my wife is out of town movies. She will just not watch movies like that.
She doesn't like thrillers.
No violence.
My wife is
no
kind of like that too. Anything with like suspense, my wife's like,
out.
Yeah.
So anytime I get like two nights a year of at home, no family.
If you're going to do that though, Children of Men's one to waste one of those on because
it's
like top 10 best movies ever, I think.
So I'm going into this movie, which you kindly showed me, thinking, it's not going to be that dystopian. It's like that's Children of Men is like the freaking world is over. It's like there's no one appropriate. People are just getting shot left and right. It's terrible. And I watch this movie and I'm like, oh my God, it is actually really dystopian and really dark and not at all what I was expecting. So here's my question. This is a layup movie. This concept is a layup. I could see a studio being like, family arguments, they're throwing potatoes at each other.
Yeah.
It's like the Adele sketch from SNL where her song unites these arguing people. Like, make that movie. And you're like, I'm going to make this movie that is almost frighteningly realistic to at least some viewers. So how – like – that is a very interesting decision. Did you get pushback? Are you happy with the tone of the movie?
Yeah. You know, right away, when I started kind of breaking the story, I knew just kind of right away that it was not going to fit into one drama neatly. I knew if I decided to tonally make this a straight up comedy, I think we'd be missing a lot of opportunities. And I think a lot of people would watch it and be like, okay, it was funny, but you're not, you know, you're not respecting the gravity of the situation and the very real feelings that people have now and how the, you know, politics has permeated every layer. And on the same token, if I would have made this just a very serious, thrilling drama, you know, A, that's just a little off brand for me, too much so maybe. And I think people then would be like, well, now you're missing the kind of the heart and the human aspects of it and the family aspects. So I always knew it was going to be a bit of a odd bird in the sense we were going to try to make people laugh really hard. We have hard jokes in there. We have some actual like big comedy setups and stuff. But then we also have some pretty dark, gritty violence and some, you know, blood and guns and guts. So I also knew that this was not going to be a studio movie. And you're very right. I could have leaned into this and been like, Tiffany and, you know, the guy from Blockers and the girl from Girls Trip are having a family.
Yeah, well, I should mention that Tiffany Haddish is in it because she's incredibly famous now.
She's like very famous and she's very good in the movie. But, so I always knew it was going to be an indie jam. I just always knew that this was going to be a movie that I needed to find really gutsy producers who didn't shy away from things that were, you know, a little interesting and different. And, so we always knew that was going to be the path. And we got just very lucky, you know, along the way. You know, we had a lot of help on the script stage from, you know, the great Dave Stassen and Mindy Kaling read a very early draft of it. And then we found these guys, QC Entertainment, who produced Get Out and Black Klansman.
You mentioned Get Out as well as, and again, a very unsettling, surreal almost setting, and that, like, honestly, I don't want to reveal too much.
Yeah.
But this family comes under threat from government surveillance and authoritarianism in their house. My wife was like, I'm now frightened. This movie is now frightening me.
You should have waited until she's on vacation.
Well, I was like, because I was like, this is going to be a fun political commentary, kind of edgy, and she was like, I'm kind of getting scared.
It's about similar to Get Out, where Get Out takes this concept of racism and kind of puts it through this weird filter and you get this crazy suspenseful horror film. I think we take the concept of politics and put it through this lens of kind of a funny, thrillery thing. So just like Get Out, I would not say Get Out's about racism per se. It's clearly inspired by racism. This is not about politics. That's like the one misconception I would tell people. Like, oh, it's about politics. No, no, no. This is about an American family and the modern and how the modern political climate combined with the, you know, onslaught of 24-hour news and fake news and Twitter. It's taking like really what were like a couple years ago, like normal happy-go-lucky people, and it's like breaking their brains a little bit, and it's making it very difficult to have these, you know, annual family gatherings that we're so used to.
So the one of the ways you add humor into the movie is sort of these trivial life problems or these trivial little things sort of invade serious situations and like temporarily distract the people in the serious situation. They go on like a 2-minute debate about some like trivial thing that's
like
happening.
Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Chris Rock.
Yeah.
Speed bumps. I don't want to say too much. There's a scene where they go, where there's like a diversion into speed bumps where John Cho, who's in the film, told me it's his favorite bit in the whole movie. And so like, I just wonder when you go down these detours of humor and then you come back to, this scary story. When you saw first cut of it, when you saw the finished cut of it, were you like, I just can't imagine owning something like this and thinking, did I find the right balance? Like, does everything mesh holistically? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's one thing to write it and you're like, I know it's weird, it's crazy, and the tone's weird, but let's just keep shooting it. And then when you're shooting it, you're just a bit in a submarine, right? You can't see the surface, but you know, in the sub, it feels good. The proof, when our editor, Jack Price, showed us his assembly, we all breathed a sigh of relief because we knew we had a lot of work ahead of us still, but we knew that on kind of a fundamental, both tonal and structural level, the movie worked. We knew that we were able to kind of go back and forth, you know, with the thriller aspect and the comedy aspect, and we knew it worked. But the first thing you gotta do is you gotta show your movie to your friends and ask them to tear it apart. Like you got to be brutally honest. So I took my friend Liz Kakowski, who's a great writer, Mindy, Seth Rogen and Jordan Peele. And I put them in the movie theater and I made them watch it. And they all had amazing notes. And Jordan really was kind of like a, you know, his most of his notes, he was like, look, I love what you're doing with the tone. He's like, it's, he did a little bit in Get Out. Like Get Out would have like an incredibly scary scene and then you cut to like, you know, Lil Rel, you know, talking to the cops being like, it's sex slaves.
Yeah.
So he was familiar with that. He's like, this can work. You can sustain this for the whole movie. But he's like, you have to keep your eye on the scale because there's some moments where you have a really scary or very emotionally charged moment. And then you cut it with a joke, which is great. That's great. But you have another joke after that sometimes, or even two jokes after that. And, you know, we call that in the business a hat on a hat.
A hat on a hat. All right. And I learn a new term every time I have a comedian on.
I have so many.
Mandy told me about 10 percenters.
He said
that's a joke we write into, it was Parks and Rec at the time, where we know that only 10% of the audience will get it, and we write it anyway because that 10% will love it so much.
Oh, I like that. I always liked schmuck bait. You ever heard of that?
No.
Schmuck bait. That's if your character is, you say that your character is going to do something that the audience knows he's not going to do. Like if on like the first episode of Seinfeld, if like Jerry was like, should I move to LA? And you're like, you know, he's not going to move to LA. Right. It's schmuck bait.
Okay.
Anyways, Jordan's point was, he's like, if you tip the scales too much and if you go from a really scary beat and then you have too much humor, you push the scale and then it's that much harder for the audience to transition back to being scared. So going forward, every subsequent cut, we really kept checking the scales and we made sure it was like, you know, passing the Peele test of, you know, are we balancing this properly? And I think at the end, you know, we got to a place that I was very proud of it. I'm very proud of it. I'm very happy with it. You know, you do get to a place where you do start kind of just, I've seen it now over 200 times.
Oh,
and you just,
wow.
I know. That's crazy. It's hardcore. Like we have screenings now and I'm like literally like, I'm going to show up for the last 20 minutes.
Yeah. Why would you?
Yeah. And, but you start to only like focus on the things that you wish you could change and whatnot. But we knew that it worked and it was just like Seth Rogen's like, you directed a fucking insane movie. And you have to be proud of it because it's never been done before and it's entertaining as hell and I think people are going to like it and that's good enough for me.
I was entertained the whole way through. I will say my primary reaction to it was being uncomfortable.
Like yes.
Being frightened and uncomfortable. And the humor bits hit, but the primary reaction for me, the primary takeaway, even at the end where you've talked about this so I don't feel bad saying it, you say there's a happy ending and you wrote an unhappy ending alternatively. The ending even didn't strike me as very happy.
The ending was, there was a lot of discussion, and without giving away too many spoilers, there was a lot of discussion, and I can say, you know, Dave Stassen, we're talking about Dave Stassen like it's David
like
Robinson,
yeah.
You know, yeah. But him and some other people they were ahead of a more visceral reaction, which a lot of audience members have, were like, oh no, people have to die. Like we have to like really go there. And I resisted it because I wanted the movie to end optimistically. And I know it's not like they're holding hands running through a flower garden with their little kid. But at that moment, right, and again, try not to spoil it too much. At that moment, it seems to be behind them. And, you know, I think about America a lot when I was making this movie. And without getting, you know, too political, despite last week, which was a pretty bad week if you're someone who is left-leaning. That was a very depressing week. I'm still optimistic about America. I'm still feel strongly that we do have cycles in this country and we don't know what tomorrow will bring and we know what yesterday brought, but sometimes we do have to kind of just live in that moment where we're safe and we have the people we love and celebrate that.
Is there any chance that the movie's dystopian nature is a subconscious allegory for what it's like to be a Bulls fan in 2018-19. Did that cross your mind? Like the officers who invade the house are maybe like the Iowa State Mafia coming to take you away if you don't support what they're doing. Have you thought about that at all?
There's a metaphor hidden in there, which if you really watch the movie, you'll see it's clearly a metaphor for them. What would have happened if they kept Jimmy Butler? Where they would probably be the fourth best team in the East right now. going into the season, and maybe with a couple trades, they'd be competitive with the Celtics, and then, you know, get destroyed by someone in the West. To answer your question, yes, there is a sadness.
Listen up, people. We have a big favor to ask, and we promise it won't take up too much of your time. You know, our show is supported by some fantastic sponsors, right? Well, we'd love to hear your feedback. Head to podcastlisteners.com and fill out a short anonymous survey. That's it. That's all there is, we swear. Again, that's podcastlisteners.com. You mentioned Jordan Peele. Now we're going to bounce around.
Let's do it.
Mention Jordan Peele. I did not know this about you. It turns out there are lots of things about people's lives you don't know until you like really read about them and talk to them.
You have to go to Wikipedia, where I edit my own page every day. I wake up and I add stuff and I delete stuff and I maintain that page.
You, when you were trying to break into comedy, lived in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
Doing sketch comedy. Yeah. Among your circle of friends was Jordan Peele.
Yes.
Kay Cannon, who I believe directed Blockers.
Directed the movie Blockers.
Which
dear
is,
friend.
Which is really funny.
Really funny. Like people, first of all, a lot of people, a lot of my friends, and I'm saying that with air quotes, are like, I finally saw Blockers on my flight. And I'm like, oh, thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks for not paying $12 for a ticket for your old pal.
I did it on demand. Is that all right?
That's fine. You paid for it.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, God, that's fine. As long as you're not having
$5.99,
Delta.
$5.99, I think.
Okay, you could have gotten a couple weeks ago. Could have been $8.99. It's fine.
Sorry.
But it's better than having Delta pick up the tab on your flight to Boston. But a very funny movie. And Kay was there, and at the time, Kay was married to Jason Sudeikis, or they were dating.
I did not know
they
that.
Were together for a long time. And so
Seth
he was
Myers.
Seth Myers was there. Josh Myers was there. Liz Kakowski, who I mentioned, is an amazing writer. We had a really great group, and it was a really great time to be like 23 and living in Europe. It was like,
Amsterdam, a very sober city, very very no, very, very calm. Mostly, nobody misbehaves there.
We mostly toured churches.
Yeah.
I spent a lot of time at the Anne Frank House. It was bedlam.
I was told to ask by someone who shall remain anonymous.
Dave Stassi.
Anonymous. No.
Oh.
It takes away at like 1% of this person's anonymity.
Got it.
Is it, ask like, did he really try to punch a cab driver in Amsterdam?
I did. And I think Jordan Peele was in the cab. In Amsterdam, there's one primary cab company called TCA. And they're really like the mafia. They're like a very close-knit, they're like gangsters. And whenever a new taxi company comes in town, they'll like, break their windows, and they're just horrible jerks.
Don't tell me this is like you're going to be you taking a stand for the opening up of the
all
the
I want to say is
the
this,
cab
there's
industry.
Lots of other modes of transportation, and we should welcome other companies and bring them into the fold, and it can't just be one company. No, they were just jerks. And there was one night one guy like wouldn't take us to where we wanted to go and started yelling at us. I feel like it was Jordan, and I think I threw a punch at him like over the thing, because they were ready to fight. They were like thugs.
Okay.
Guys, like Dutch taxi driver thugs. They're just like big, angry, like old European men. And I threw a punch at one of them.
So, and this is just all of you are trying out material, or you're doing sketch comedy every night for audiences of how many? This is like just the workshop era.
Well, yeah, I mean, yes and no. I really actually think Chicago. So I did put in my years in Chicago, like 96 to 99, and that was really my workshop.
Okay.
Like Improv Olympic, Second City, the Annoyance Theater.
Which I have questions about.
You had a day job, and then you would take classes and perform and stuff. But Amsterdam, the reason I went was because I had heard about it. And it was originally this theater company. It was founded by three Northwestern grads who were backpacking. And they were like, hey, I like Amsterdam, but the comedy's bad. Let's open a theater. And it started off like a small thing, but by the time I auditioned, it was big. And they had like 200-plus seats, and it was a dinner theater. And the thing is, they paid you to act. You didn't have to have another job. So that was really, more than anything, I was like, oh, I just don't want to have my day job anymore.
Right.
I hate it so much. So I got hired, and I kind of, in effect, replaced Seth Myers there, and his partner, Jill Benjamin. And it was a dream, because, like I said, you could sleep in.
Right.
And we would put up these kind of sketch comedy shows. The show was basically, have you ever seen a Second City show?
Yeah.
So imagine a Second City show with like 2 to 3 improvised games inside of it.
Okay.
So it's basically like a Whose Line Is Anyway meets Second City.
Right.
And we would, once a year write a new show, and but you would do like maybe like 5 to 6 shows a week, and you would add in a few corporate shows. So so you made enough money to live, and you could use that money to buy legal pot, which was like insane to think of back then. And
this is 20 years ago.
This is 20 years ago, man.
Almost.
And it was just this very special moment where we were all there and everyone was young, and it was like before 9/11, and it was before the euro, the guilder was still there, so it was 2-1, so you felt like everything was half off. It was really great, and they did prepare you to kind of put up a sketch show, and kind of from there I did meet Seth and his brother Josh and Jill, and we, the four of us and Dave Stassen, after a couple of years, we said, hey, let's go to LA, and that was kind of where we took off from.
So Seth Meyers is obviously now a giant star, yes. And became one not long after that.
Yeah, he got hired. We all moved to LA and had horrible waiter jobs for a minute, and in about 8 months Seth got hired by SNL, and we were just like, oh my god,
Sudeikis, giant star.
Yeah,
Jordan Peele, Academy Award winner,
Academy Award winner Jordan Peele.
Can you tell at age 25 that these guys are just supernova talents?
I mean, yes, but the ceiling was like going back to Chicago and being on the Second City main stage.
Right.
We didn't even think it was possible that they would be on SNL. With that said, like, Jason Sudeikis like destroys in front of audiences. Like, he's one of the fastest minds I've ever seen. Seth Meyers is like so charming. Jordan was like younger than us, but like so just special and different, and like watching the audience connect with him. So like, we knew everyone was special and we knew that they were great, but like, you know, I actually did this, I had a screening at the 92nd Street Y last night with Seth Meyers, and we were just laughing like, you know, we knew back then, like, you look at Jordan Peele, like, oh, he's going to be an Oscar winner. This man who has, like, holes in his shirt, who's, like, rolling a joint on the, you know, cobblestones. And, like, you know, I just said last night, I knew one day when I met Ike Barinholtz in 1999, he was my friend that was least likely to write and direct a movie where I'd be moderating a panel. So we had no idea. I mean, we obviously had these, you know, goals and stuff, but we had no idea that any of this.
The only reason I ask is we were watching, my wife and I were watching SNL, the first Kavanaugh episode.
Yeah, yeah. Matt Damon was really funny.
Well, and just Kate McKinnon as Lindsey Graham. Oh. I don't know how old Kate McKinnon is. Like, I don't know if she's in her mid-30s.
Mid-30s, yeah.
I turned to my wife and I was like, she's just so incredible. She gets, or even her neck was like bulging out as Lindsey Graham.
She's,
I just like, how is she not famous at like 22? She just, yeah. She must have just been instantly, like the first time you put your eyes on her, like she's just different than ever. She's just different.
Yeah. And it does take time too. Like, you takes time, I think, to find yourself. I can't speak for Kay. I know she's like one of the funniest people on the planet and she's awesome and lovely, but sometimes it does take a minute. Like, it takes a minute to kind of find your comedic POV. And, you know, I didn't find mine until, oh gosh, maybe a little bit halfway during my term in Boom Chicago. I was a great improviser and I was great in the Chicago stage, but I still didn't have my kind of POV figured out yet. And I know, you know, no one really did. Sudeikis kind of did, just because his just kind of thing is, you know, the Jason Sudeikis thing, which is real fast and kind of loose and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's hard to, it just takes time and to kind of get that POV, you need life experience. You need to go through some bad stuff. You need to go through some breakups and pain. You can always be like, unless you're Chris Farley, you know?
Right.
Who's just like, you're like, got it. Yeah. It takes a little bit of time for some people.
I also think of the famous Will Ferrell screen test for SNL.
Oh,
and there,
God.
And there's a sketch where he's just yelling at someone to get off the shed. And you're just like, that's it.
That's it.
This guy's got it.
Yeah, like, Will's one of those
give
freaks.
Give him the whole show.
Yeah, he's one of those freaks. You ever seen Phil Hartman's?
I think so.
Where he's like, I can do any impression you want. Any impression. Name someone. Anyone. And someone yells like, Tom Selleck. He goes, can't do Tom Selleck. Give me another one. Someone's like, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Goes, no, I don't know that one, but I can do any other one. And he just kind of went down and down and down.
Once every 2 years, I remember that Phil Hartman is dead, and I get really sad.
There's a few that like are on my real sad list. That one, David Bowie, you're just real sad about Farley. I hung out with Farley a few times. You know, when I was a busboy at Second City, his brother, John or Kevin, I can't remember which one, was on at the touring company. And every once in a while, Farley would show up, man. And he was a hurricane, and he was so nice. and so funny. And he would show up, and he always had like a big joint. And he was like, "How you doing? Where's Johnny? Where's gotta find Johnny?" He was just a wonderful, wonderful guy. But that's that kind of sad list where you're like, oh, I really wish they were here right now. I could really use them.
Who's an impression that you really wish you could do but you can't?
That's really good. An impression I wish,
because you do a lot. You have a good Obama.
My Obama, I grew up in Chicago, and there's this basketball court downtown, and I think Mike Dave might have told you this. We used to play basketball there in the 90s, and there was this skinny black dude who played with us, and never really talked to him. It was Barack Obama.
It's unbelievable.
This is a true story. He one time, and he was pretty good, actually. A lot of people are like, I heard he's not good at basketball. I said, no, he's good. He's like fast and stuff. And this one time, he went up for a shot, and Dave went up with him and hacked him. And Obama came down, like, I saw rage in his eyes. He points in Dave's face, goes, "Don't fucking undercut me, kid. Don't do that shit. Don't do that shit again." And literally, like,
oh my God.
Still to this day, when I see him speak, like, he could be saying anything like, "As Americans, we must come together. It's one people." And all I hear is, "Don't fucking undercut me, kid."
So you didn't answer the question.
If I could,
that's a hard question.
If
that's
I could
do,
I would love to be able to do a Howard Stern impression.
Okay,
I mean, I can't get my voice that low, but it's something like that would be really like, he's a very elusive one. Only a couple people can do a really good Howard Stern. I would say that.
I've read that you do a Trebek.
No, you know what it was? Someone. My Alex Trebek, all it is just, no, the answer is, it's
well,
just,
that's what I was going to say. Can you do Alex Trebek being obnoxious to someone who has given a bad, that's my favorite. It's, ooh, of course we're looking for croissant. Yeah, you know, it's my favorite Alex Trebek.
No, the answer is Halifax. Ooh, of Halifax course. Halifax should have known that one. Anyways.
He'll throw in an of course. Ooh, of course we're looking for Sydney, Australia.
Well, I think people think that because we did a sketch on Mad TV one time where we did a Jeopardy and I imitated Alex Trebek. And if you do an impression once, even if it's one line, like I did an impression of John Mahoney, the dad on Frasier, mm-hmm. and I had one line in the sketch. I was like, I'm John Mahoney, and they list that now on some website, like Ike's impressions. And I was like, out of these 200 impressions, there's like four that I can kind of do without sweating.
Right.
Obama's one of them.
Scratch that question. So you directed this film.
I did.
Which is very impressive to me. So I don't know how films work, how they get made. So I'm always curious. I'm dying to ask you. So you direct the film. I watch a movie and I'm like, I just can't even understand how to begin being like, I want to shoot this scene from here, here, and here. And then I want to zoom in on this person's face. And then I want to have this like 10-minute tracking shot. You have like a Robert Altman tracking shot at some point in this movie.
I love you.
I just like, so I'm asking the stupidest question, which is like, where are you sitting? How are you planning this? Like, I want to know the very dumb mechanics of directing a movie because I just don't understand. It seems like an impossible, enormous task.
I think there are some freaks who, like, they devote their entire childhood to reading about film. And by the time they're like 14, like, they're like Steven Spielberg just has an innate sense to like how to set up shots. He just like, you watch that. Did you watch that documentary about him?
Not yet.
It's fantastic. And you see these movies he made on Super 8 when he was like 12 and they're like good. Like he has like special effects in them. And he has good shots. It's crazy. So there's those people. For me, it was, you know, I loved film. It's a bit of an ongoing process to get to where I got to, right? I loved watching movies. And, when I was young, I bought, Spike Lee wrote a book, basically like The Making of Do the Right Thing, the book. And it's basically his director's journal. And I remember being I was like 12 when I read it, and I was very taken by how he kind of broke down a scene and how he wrote sample dialogue and fleshed stuff out. So I always kind of had that in my mind a little bit when I watched a movie. And then, you know, once I started being in movies, I would, you know, you're always on set. You're kind of just surrounded by it. And if you have an interest for it, it's right there. You know what I mean? It's like if you were somewhere and there's a basketball game going on, you can just kind of turn and watch the game, right? But it was really Mindy, who really encouraged me. And, you know, basically, on the Mindy project and on a lot of sitcoms, you when you write an episode, they basically have you produce it, right? You go to all the meetings and you, you know, you're on set for every take and everything and you're involved in the casting. So Dave and I wrote, I think, the 9th episode of the first season of The Mindy Project. And we, just because I think there's two of us, and Mindy always refers to us as affable Midwestern writing team. and because we are like just guys who grew up, you know, in a city and can talk to people and stuff, we're just good with talking to crew and good with talking to actors. I'm an actor. I know how to like, you know, communicate between actors and directors.
By the way, and you act in, you got all sorts of range in this movie.
I'm going on
anger. You got
fury, rage,
fear.
No, I do. It's
not just funny guy Ike.
No, it's definitely a little bit deeper. But because we were on set so much, Mindy and another one of our producers, a guy named Mike Spiller, really kind of encouraged Dave and I to direct. And just again being there, I just had a natural curiosity. I would say to our DP, like, "What are you doing right now?" He's like, I'm testing light and I'm making sure that this scene, I want to shoot this scene right here because I love that on this, you know, nice key light I'm getting here, but it doesn't really work for this. Just small things you pick up on. And then when you direct it, you start putting those pieces together. And then in terms of like the actual movie, like when you're directing that, like, you know, again, you watch that Spielberg documentary and it's wild. He's like, when I get to set, I don't know what I'm going to do. I just walk in and whatever feels right. And I'm like, oh my God, that's like, that would be the most fun thing in the world. I'm the opposite. I'm at home weeks before being like, okay, I know, you know, especially for my first movie, like, for this scene, you know, I know we need like, you know, the master shot, which is kind of the, you know, the camera's kind of the widest and it's kind of where you can kind of see the whole scene. You could, if you needed to show the whole scene in one shot, that would be your master shot.
Okay.
And then you're going to kind of break in and cover the scene. You're going to get coverage. So we had a master shot. The camera's by that door and it's shooting you and I right now. So you could see us doing a podcast, but then we would come in and get your coverage, close-ups of you, different angle of you. We get a close-up of me. We put a camera right here. We get a call to 50-50, which is kind of like a confrontational shot. So you start to learn the, you know, the terms and the purposes they serve. And, you know, I wanted to push myself just enough where I felt I had a few kind of, as you refer to it, as an Altman steady. But at the same time, you know, it's my first movie and, it was actually my DP's first time being a DP. He's normally like a camera op for like big, like X-Men and stuff. But we wanted to make sure we weren't getting ourselves in a position where we were focusing more on the shots and the look than the story and the dialogue, which is really what it's about.
How do you land in a place where you're like, this is the time for my 4-minute tracking shot or whatever the right terminology is?
That's tracking shot's perfect. I knew that, I couldn't, just because of the nature of the movie, it was going to be a lot of quick kind of jump cuts and fast cuts.
Tight spaces.
And so I knew that I wanted at least one really nice long tracking shot. And when I was kind of breaking the story, I thought to myself, okay, well, the perfect place to do that is that, you know, Thanksgiving Day, because the camera follows me. It's almost, I kind of stole it from Boogie Nights, the last shot of Boogie Nights when Burt Reynolds is walking through the house.
Okay.
And you see, like,
it's been a while for me.
The end of the movie has this really like organy, sad song playing as he's walking through the house and he steps in and he says hi to, you know, Heather Graham. Then he walks out and he sees, you know, what's his name? The guy's like, what's up, Jack? How you doing, Jack? Luis Guzman. And then he goes in and he sees another person. So I wanted just to kind of put the audience in my POV of like, this is the house during Thanksgiving Day. You got mom and me cooking. You got everyone's in the back room, watching the football game and picking their feet and the kids are in the pine cone. And I'm going to come back out. You want to make it look beautiful for the audience, tell a story, and also like there's a few little setups in there. Like I want to show the Thanksgiving table before you see the Thanksgiving table at dinner, so I wanted to make sure we continue through there. I want to make sure I connect with Carrie Brownstein for a second before she peels
She's
off.
She's very funny in this
She's
movie.
Great. So it is just kind of a balance.
She might have my favorite line in the whole movie, which I won't spoil on.
I'm
on
so
her.
Curious. Tell me when we wrap. But you want every shot to tell a story, and some of the ones are longer stories.
Listeners, we can debate endlessly about the NBA and all the teams we love and hate and all this, but I think we can agree on one thing. We could all use more sleep. NBA teams are constantly talking about sleep, and getting a great night's sleep is easier and more affordable than you think. You don't need to spend $3,000 on a mattress or buy sleeping pills. You just need to change your sheets. Interesting. That's why you should check out Boll & Branch. Everything Boll & Branch makes, from bedding to blankets, is made from pure 100% organic cotton, which means they start out super soft and they somehow even get softer over time. Which doesn't seem possible, but apparently it's true. You buy directly from them, so you're essentially paying wholesale prices. Luxury sheets can cost up to $1,000 in the store, which is absolutely insane, but Boll & Branch sheets are only a couple $100. That's reasonable. Everyone who tries Boll & Branch sheets loves them. That's why they have thousands of five-star reviews, and Forbes, The Wall Street Journal, Fast Company have all talked about Boll & Branch. Even three U.S. presidents sleep on Boll & Branch sheets. That's probably good. Shipping is free, and you can try them for 30 nights. If you don't love them, send them back for a refund. That easy. But I doubt you want to send them back. There's no risk, no reason not to give them a try. And to get started right now, my listeners get $50 off your first set of sheets at BollAndBranch.com. Promo code LOW, L-O-W-E, the name of this podcast, my last name. Go to BollAndBranch.com today for $50 off your first set of sheets. That's Boll, B-O-L-L, and Branch.com. Promo code LOW, L-O-W-E.
Who is your favorite Bulls player of all time that's not Michael Jordan or Scottie Pippen?
Oh, that's not Scottie Pippen. Woo! Okay, give me a second here, because there's a lot of different answers. My first gut instinct is John Paxson.
Okay.
Because at our high school, he came to our trivia night and did this like celebrity trivia match against us, and it was like in the middle of Bulls Mania in like 1993.
Hold on. He's competing against the students?
So Dave Sasson and I were in this thing called Scholastic Bowl. You know, do you guys have that in Connecticut?
We had something like that. I did not do it,
right,
because I would be too embarrassed at age 15 to get it wrong. No, just to get, I was nerdy enough to do it. I was just like, if I get a wrong answer. To this day, I'm too scared to even like try to get on Jeopardy, because I know that basketball would be a category,
and you would and I'll Cliff be like, Clavin it.
Yeah, and I was, and I can't show my face anywhere ever again.
Cliff Clavin on Cheers on Jeopardy is one of the top 10 best comedy. You remember that episode?
Of course,
it's one of the greatest episodes. Like the categories he gets in first are like postal codes, local Boston trivia, the Celtics. who are two people who have not been in my kitchen?
Which is technically accurate.
That is true, though, Alec. We were in Quiz Bowl, and our team was incredible. We won the Illinois State Championship in 1994. Like, literally, we were the best team in the state. Now, listen, we wore that because this one guy on our team was a genius.
Okay.
But I answered a few every time. Another guy answered a little more than me. Dave answered one or two. And we had a big night for like a fundraiser to send us to nationals or something. And we tried to get local Chicago celebrities to show up. And Paxson agreed.
Sure. Yeah. John Paxson got nothing better to do.
Yeah, right, right. This is literally, like I said, this is like when he is still like the starting point guard. This is like before BJ became a starter. And he shows up and he's a wonderful, handsome guy. And there was a question. This person holds the, it was basically this person holds the record for average points per game in the playoffs. And Paxson rang in, and he rang in and said Kareem, because he didn't listen to the question. That he just thought it was who's the leading scorer.
Right.
So he said Kareem, and the host goes, no. And I go, I look at John, and I'm such a dick. I go, a guy named Michael Jordan, never heard of him.
Oh God.
And Paxson turned like beat red, and the whole audience laughed. It's like
storms.
This like 14-year-old kid just totally made fun of this like Chicago legend. But I remember, it's either Paxson. I loved watching Tony Kukoc play. I loved Horace. I'm gonna stick with my gun. I'm gonna say Paxson.
Everyone has a role player that catches their fancy for whatever reason.
They were like, to grow up in Chicago in the 90s, it was like growing up in London if you lived near the Rolling Stones, or like growing up in Liverpool in the 60s, because they were always around. The Bulls liked to go out around town and stuff.
Oh, there are stories. I have a friend who grew up in Chicago who claims to have saw them out multiple times and has stories.
I'll never forget one night my parents were at a fundraiser, and my dad called me. I was babysitting my brother. I go, hello? My dad goes, hold on. And he hands the phone. And the guy goes, hi, how are you? And I go, good. And the guy goes, have a nice day. And my dad takes the phone and goes, that was Bill Weddington.
Oh, wow. Very nice.
Nice of Bill.
Yeah.
Nice guy.
Good sport.
They were if I was to take one word that described my teenage years, it was basketball. The Bulls were – I can't think of a comp in any city, even if you're like a Pats fan in the last 10 years or a Yankee fan in the 2000s, they were everything. I think I watched every Bulls game. I'm not kidding. You dropped everything and watched the Bulls. I can name every player in the Bulls between 1990 and 1995, I think. And it's just, it was so fun. And if you weren't watching the Bulls, you were playing basketball by yourself. It was basketball dominated every aspect of our life. Much like politics does now, it was basketball then.
How many Chicago Bulls games will you watch start to finish this season? Over under, I'm saying the over under at 4.5.
I will watch over that.
Okay.
But not by much. I was going to say like 6, 7.
Okay.
I got to say, I will always be a Bulls fan, first and foremost, no matter what. With that said, very excited to live in a town where LeBron James is playing. I love him. I love watching him play. I love what he represents. I love who he is. And I think they're going to be a bit of a mess this year. You know, I think they'll probably, you know, maybe be 6th, 7th best team in the West, maybe a little better. And they're going to be weird, like Rondo and him, just weird. But I'm there for it. I can't wait. My goal is to see LeBron play at least once live this year.
Pick one of these two stories and expound upon it, please. These are from David. You played, apparently in some context, you played basketball against Mark McGuire, or Mark McGuire's ass. You lifted weights in Marco Yarich's house, which I just don't even know where to begin.
I'm going to tell you both stories. Marco, the same gym we played at Obama and played with Obama in Chicago. Whenever like players were in from out of town, they would go to this gym to play, right?
And Mark McGuire was a badass. For people who are younger than us and don't know who, like what Mark McGuire was, he was a tough SOB.
I remember when they traded, he went to Detroit for Adrian Dantley, and people lost their minds because Dantley was amazing, a beautiful shot, was so great, and Aguirre showed up and just changed that dynamic of that team. And he's a local guy, went to DePaul. Yeah. He shows up to play ball one day, and I'm like, I'll guard him. And he's very big, but he's not like very tall. He's like maybe, I'm going to guess Mark Aguirre is 6'4", maybe 6'3"-ish. He's just like a man. I was a boy. That is a man, and he is a big man. Like his butt was so big. It was so big. And I'm guarding this guy. I'm kind of excited because I'm playing basketball against an NBA guy. And to this day, I'd never forget. Like, here's how that went. He's dribbling the ball just in front of the top of the key. And I kind of run up and he's just dribbling slowly and looking at me. And I kind of run up to try to swipe the ball. And all he does is just kind of slightly turn his butt. And you like run into his butt and you get knocked back. And then all he does is like look in your eye while he shoots like a 40-foot three. And it was still to this day by far the best player I'll ever play against ever in a million years. It was incredible. Marco Yark.
I just can't even imagine how this happens.
So when I was living in LA, I'd been there a few years, and Dave moved to DC to go work for PTI. And I was living in LA in this house with Josh Myers and another one of our friends, this guy Hayes MacArthur is from Chicago. And Josh moved out and we had an empty bedroom. And Hayes had an aunt who lived in LA, and he's like, I knew she like was a manager of some kind. And Hayes said to me, he's like, hey man, we have that empty bedroom. You might have a couple models who my aunt represents move in? And I was like, sure, whatever. And a week later, I come home, and there's these two girls from Serbia that are there. Just gorgeous. Like straight up, like models you would see in a magazine, right? And they lived with us for a year. And, nothing, I swear to you, like, literally nothing. They were so pretty, like, we couldn't even, like hit on them. You know, they were just two, they were like different species, yeah, almost.
I was gonna say a different species.
Different
of
species,
humans.
Yeah. But they were really nice to us, you know, and I'll never forget. I said to one of them, I was like, they were going down Sunset. I go, be careful. It gets a little dicey. She goes, I'm from Belgrade. The bomb fell on my school. I was like, you're good. You're good, honey.
I don't know why I'm laughing,
but
it's not surprising.
One night they were like, do you want to come to party with us? Do you want to go to a friend's house?
That's a yes.
Yeah. We're like, yes. Hayes and I are like, yeah, let's go. And we go to Marco Yarick's house. He's got this amazing house up in the hills when he's playing for the Clippers. And we go up to his house, and we walk up and like Marco Yark is like so not excited to see Hayes and I. He thought he was going to get these two beautiful women. And these two big American dudes. Hey, what's up, man? How you doing? Big Bulls fan, but I like you. Okay. And we get there and he has this gorgeous pool. It looks like a house you would see in like an 80s movie, like a bad guy. But he has this beautiful pool and like next to the pool, he has like an outdoor gym. So we're there, you know, and the girls are there and I'm trying to impress him, you know, and he's got a weight bench and he's got a little, barbell. And I didn't even check it. And I go, do you guys mind if I do some sets? And I get on it and there's a 45 on one side and nothing on the other. And I right away, it falls and half the bar lands on my chest, but it's like falling the wrong way. And I go, Hayes, get it off me. And Hayes has to like run over and like lift up the bar. And I like come out under it. I'm like, and it was like, if there was any chance of these girls ever seeing me as attractive, like there was a 1% chance, it like, I watched it fly away into the air. And Marco Yarick was like,
did he witness it?
He was there. He was like, I think he didn't like us, but then he just like took pity on us. He didn't talk to us the rest of the night. It was not fun.
Listeners, the truth is that most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, or not for long enough, or we forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing, but not Quip. So what makes Quip different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, and it packs just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. It has a built-in timer that makes sure you clean for the dentist recommended 2 minutes, and it has guiding pulses that tell you when to switch sides. It has a subscription plan that is good for your health and your convenience. They deliver new brush heads on a dentist recommended schedule, and you got to do what the dentist recommends. And they do that every 3 months for just $5, including free shipping anywhere in the world. Quip comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror and unsticks to use as a cover for your hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth, which is really wherever you go. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They're on Oprah's O list, named one of Time's best inventions, and it's the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. That seems authoritative. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists and hundreds of thousands of happy brushers using Quip every day. Quip starts at $25, which is not really what you'd expect for a high-end electric toothbrush. And if you go to getquip.com/roll right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with the Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free at getquip.com/low, L-O-W-E, my last name, the name of this podcast. That's getquip.com/low, GETQUIP.com/low, L-O-W-E.
I meant to ask you this before, talking about Chicago.
Yeah.
You talk about being an usher at Second City. You've talked about this before. I mean, and we all know the royalty that has come through Second City. You mentioned in particular Tim Meadows struck you.
Yes.
And was part of the reason you were like, I want to keep doing this. Now, Tim Meadows is funny. I like Tim Meadows whenever he's in stuff. It's like a net plus all the time.
Sure.
Great on SNL, had some iconic characters, the ladies man, all that. Yep. It's just not the name that you if you said Tina Fey or Amy Poehler or Steve Carell, I would have been like, oh, that makes sense. Tim Meadows is like this massively important figure at this time. So tell me why. What was it?
It was the Improv Olympics, I think their 10th or 15th anniversary show. And it was the first time I saw like improv. And all their alumni came. And looking back, the show was bad. But Amy Poehler was there. And Adam McKay was there. And Chris Farley shot a bit. And they were all amazing and funny and exciting and vibrant and sexy. And it was great, but it was not until Tim Meadows, right? There's a scene going on and they established that the people in the scene are waiting in line to see a movie. And Tim Meadows, they don't say what movie it is. And Tim Meadows finally enters the scene. It's called a walk-on when you walk onto a scene. And he walks up to the line. He goes, are you dudes waiting in line to see that movie Solo? Which at the time was a movie with Mario Van Peebles that opened that weekend. And it was, the tagline was Solo, part man, part machine, all weapon.
Don't remember this.
Really weird movie. It was like a Universal Soldier knockoff starring Mario Van Peebles, and it opened that weekend. So Tim Meadows comes out and goes, you dudes waiting in line to see Solo? And I'm the only one in the theater that starts like laughing. Cause it was so weird to me. And then he goes, so let me get this straight. This dude's part man, part machine, but all weapon. That's not possible. And a couple giggles, but I started laughing so hard. And what struck me was that moment, I remember seeing in the Chicago Sun-Times the day before, like, oh, the Solo, this movie, what is this? A weird movie. I'm never going to think about it again. And the fact that the next night that this guy referenced it and made like a bit about it, it blew my mind. And it was really the first time I was like, oh my God, I have a use for this now. Like this brain I have, which is filled with this useless stuff and obscure references and weird moments and just bizarre lines. I have an outlet for it because I could do that. And so it was the whole night was a kind of epiphanal, but that was the real aha moment of it, where I was like, oh, I could do that. I've performed in maybe 20, 30 shows with Tim since. And I always tell him, I was like, you know, it's cause of you, I'm here. And I go, it's cause you said Solo. He's like, that doesn't even sound funny. And I'm like, I don't think it was, but it was funny to me.
That's awesome. Well, you got to go do other promotional stuff. I first saw you a little bit on Mad TV and then a lot on the Mindy Project because my wife and I like
you
the
were
Mindy
fans.
Project.
Yes, you were an early fan of
early
the Mindy
fans.
Project.
Yeah. So it was like, let's pick it up from episode one and see. And it's just like from then it's been a rocket ship of movies with other famous people. Now you got your own movie. The Oath is out. Give the exact dates.
We're in New York, LA, weekend. And DC this weekend, and then the 19th we're everywhere.
It's a fascinating movie. Go see it. Ike Barinholtz is awesome. I hope for your sake that the Bulls exceed expectations. I do not think they will, but thank you for coming on.
Zach, thanks for having me, brother. My pleasure.
The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.